Coming up on the As One Leadership podcast.
I think if you can hold the two tensions of having a weekend experience, the gathering that we gather still, it's just that I think the gathering became, like an early writer said, became a horse laden up with too many needs. If you do everything around the weekend, if you expect people to meet community and have fellowship and open the Bible and worship and do all those things, and that's your only experience, if there's no 7 day a week church, and the Missional Church, I think, came in and reminded people that we needed a 7 day a week.
Welcome to the As One Leadership podcast. Today's guest is Pastor Kim Hammond. Kim is a father, a pastor, an author, a missional guru, and most of all, he's a great close friend. So it's wonderful to have you on the show today, Kim.
Thanks for having me, Luke. It's great to be here.
No worries, mate. You've had a really interesting life. I've got to know you over the last few years. And so I thought it'd be good for our guests at the start just to hear a bit more about you. You've had a lot of experience that have shaped you as a person. Can you give us a snapshot of your journey so far and really some of the key influences that have helped you get to where you are today?
So I was really lucky when I was a young man, teenager, I had a mentor who was a youth pastor in our church, took me under his wing, and the same guy is in my church today. So I've had this long mentoring relationship with one older guy. He seemed old when I was 15 and he was 40, now he's in his 60s. That really shaped me as a young man. I became his assistant youth pastor. He walked my wife down the aisle. He discipled me and taught me youth ministry. We planted a church together in my 20s, and then he took the church over when I went overseas. I spent 5 years in America. That really shaped me. I've been around some of the greatest missional thinkers. That's really shaped me. And I'm now at Sea Life as a pastor, and I love being in a local church, just all of the theory being grounded in practicalness.
Awesome. We're going to unpack some of that today, and I think that'll be very helpful for our listeners to hear some of those experiences and how each one of those is shaped in different ways. So really looking forward to that. As you mentioned a moment ago, you were a key part of the missional movement, kind of late 90s, I guess, early 2000s, when it really sort of started to take off. The missional movement was advocating for change within the existing church and with a return to missional living. And so how would you define the missional movement and the, kind of the dreams of it when it first emerged?
Yeah, so for me, it was kind of paradigm shifting. I grew up in a church where everything was around the weekend. You know, everything was about Sunday and Monday kind of didn't matter. It was about getting everyone to church. And so when I was at Table College doing my degree in ministry, I met a board member of Forge, the Forge Mission Training Network, started by Alan Hirsch and Michael Frost. And it had only been going a couple of years. And so for me, it was a big paradigm shift that church could be a 7 day a week, that we were to take the church to people rather than bringing people to church. The idea that Christology would inform missiology and then ecclesiology would come out of it. I think in the 90s, there wasn't many good models. It was a bit reactive. And so I think, for me, the focus on Christology, the idea of Jesus or the Gospels, was very paradigm shifting for me. It was kind of like the Matrix moment. I took that pill and I couldn't look at church the same way. It was a very prophetic message. I think it was trying to redefine church. And so that's where it got some of those early days, a bit prophetic, a bit angry. And I think it's grown up into an apostolic conversation today. Yeah. Much more into church planting now, much more into focused into the fivefold, the Ephesians 4. How do we have all the gifts working? So it was probably a very prophetic organization in the early 90s.
Yeah, so you grew up in like a traditional Pentecostal church, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't until you went to Tabor and you encountered some of that sort of teaching that it's really sparked your interest at that point.
It was. That's right. I think Tabor opened my eyes to different denominations and also to a lot of Christians that were doing things that were unmeasured. They were working with the homeless or they were working among a subgroup of people in Australia. And so their commitment to Jesus and to their mission was really inspiring.
Mm. So tell us a bit more about Forge. You met Alan Hirsch and Michael Frost and people like that in that movement. What was that all about? What did it mean to get involved with Forge and what did that shape in your life as a result?
So we decided to plant a church, right? And like when I was a kid, the only church you ever knew was a large one. And I remember saying to this guy at Table, I want to plant a church. And he said, what type? I said, well, you're a young Pentecostal. You say big, a large one. That's, you know, you don't want to do too small. That'll be sin. You don't want to be too big. That's Benny Hinn, you know? So you're kind of trying to hold this tension of faith. And he didn't look really impressed. And he said, what if God wants you to do lots of little churches? And I was like, get behind me, Satan. In the Pentecostal world, only do you think about big. And so he said, you need to do Forge. I never heard of Forge, never heard of Alan Hirsch. I was a CRC pastor, trainee. So I went along to this intensive. I was in a monastery. There's all these biker people, all these kind of sort of, you know, dreadlocked hair and I'm wearing Nike and, you know.
Not much has changed.
No, right? Nothing's changed. I still love Jordan. And I just remember hearing Michael Frost preach about the woman with the issue of blood and how he called her daughter, and Jairus fell to his knees, and how in the kingdom of God, they were brothers and sisters and they became equal in the kingdom. And I remember being blown away by this idea of the gospel's for everybody, mm-hmm. and that whether it's big or small, fragile or large, in God's economy, there's a thing about following Jesus and being faithful to that. And that Forge did that training. So I did the 1 year internship, started volunteering later, ended up working for the organisation, became the Melbourne director, and the rest is kind of history.
Yeah, so it sounds like one of those defining moments. You know, you can remember the message, you can remember where you were, and it really shaped your life. And I love it when the Holy Spirit works in moments like that, and it can really change the trajectory of your life, which it sounds like for you. So from a different perspective looking in, it feels like the missional movement really was like a pendulum. So the church had lost sight of mission. I don't know why. Maybe they got comfortable or they were just obsessed with weekends or whatever it may be. And the missional movement came in and that was really healthy and it sort of critiqued the church, and it was like a pendulum that swung and brought the church back to mission, which was wonderful. And I think that was really positive. A key part of it was that necessary critique, because I think maybe the church has stopped looking inward and the missional movement helped with that. What do you think the lasting impact of the missional movement's been on the traditional church?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think reorientating people back to the gospel and to think incarnationally, John 1:14, Jesus moved into the neighbourhood. I think the church had forgotten to move into its neighbourhood, to care about the community. It would ask the question often, if your church didn't exist, would the community care? And yes, it always felt like God's always at work, isn't he? Like through YWAM and Youth for Christ, and there's always these parachurch organisations. It's like God sometimes moves despite the local church, yet he wants its bride to be all that it can be. So again, if you bash the bride, you've got to take it up with the groom. I don't think the job is to bash the church. But the church does need prophetic calling, almost a righteous rebellion. Mm. And so a lot of the movements around the world have always been in this kind of revolution. And I think the missional movement was a time to remind the church to go out the other days. I think its gift to the church is to think about how do we contextualize the gospel. Just like going overseas, I would say if we went to Papua New Guinea and we didn't speak pidgin, we'd have to learn the language. We'd have to climb the mountain for context, to be in proximity. We don't always apply the same principles here in Officer or Narre Warren. There's, I think in Australia, further people are further away from the gospel. They don't grow up in Sunday school. They don't know church. So the missional movement reminds the church to learn the language, not to compromise the gospel. I think that was the difference between the emergent movement and the missional movement. The missional movement stayed true to the gospel. It just asked the missionary questions. This is what Leslie Newbegin and David Bosch and all those early writers did. And that influenced the church in the 70s and 80s and 90s and where we are today.
Mm. So, the emerging church never really emerged, did it? I think what emerged from that movement tended to be disgruntled ex-churchgoers that just potted the church, where the missional movement seems to have kept moving forward and, like you said before, has matured and kind of grown up in different ways. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, not thinking about your context and being in your neighbourhood, like when we planted Follow 4 years ago, that's just a bizarre concept to not want to bless your neighbourhood. And we always say we want to lift Jesus high over our region. We want our community to be better because we're here, all those sorts of things. And it's weird to think that church would have had a number of years where they didn't even think about that stuff. So I think when we talk about the lasting impact of the missional movement, I think that definitely is part of it, that most churches now aren't obsessed with the weekend. Some probably still are, but most aren't. Most are thinking about how do we contextualize, how do we meet the needs in our neighborhood, how do we find ourselves amongst the poor and underprivileged and basically anyone who doesn't know Jesus, which I think is a wonderful shift. And that's what the church is called to do, to be a light in the world and to be a city on a hill and to be incarnated into their community. So I think that's a wonderful gift from the missional movement.
I think if you can hold the two tensions of having a weekend experience, the gathering that we gather still, it's just that I think the gathering became, like an early writer said, it became a horse laden up with too many needs. If you do everything around the weekend, if you expect people to meet community and have fellowship and open the Bible and worship and do all those things, and that's your only experience, if there's no 7 day a week church, and the Missional Church, I think, came in and reminded people that we needed a 7 day a week. Follow does a great job of this. It holds that tension of doing stuff out in the week and it has a good, solid weekend experience. And I think Sea Life's trying to do that.
Mm. Yeah, I think I had a discussion recently with a missional thinker, and he was very critical of churches and they're obsessed with the weekend. And I sort of got to the point of thinking, well, actually, it's not true for most churches. Most churches are thinking about how they can go into the community. And I said to him at the time that, you know, Follow's done a lot of community stuff. We run a food van a couple of nights for homeless disadvantaged people. We work in schools. We work with local council on projects and other churches, which is great. But none of that would be possible without the gathering. You know, if we were just a small group of 20 people sitting in a lounge room, we wouldn't have the people resource, we wouldn't have the finance, we wouldn't have the energy to actually do some of the stuff we're doing. So I think it's actually very biblical, isn't it? To, you know, they met together in the temple, then they scattered into the community, they met in homes. And I think they're not the enemy of each other. They're all actually really important elements. So, yeah, so it's good.
I think it's about imagination. If you think about the 90s when we grew up in church, if you went to a conference, whether it was Hillsong, and I'm not, you know, not saying Hillsong was wrong, but people would look around and see these large auditoriums, and even Brian would say, don't copy us, but the medium's the message. Mm-hmm. So people would be looking around going, oh, no, I won't copy you. And that's all they got obsessed about, trying to copy some of these big churches. And so, you know, the church that has the train that comes into the service and picks up all the kids on the Thomas the Tank Engine train and hooks them out, what does a little Anglican church do down the road? You know, Aunt Betty comes in a cardboard cutout and says, all aboard. Kids. And so all of a sudden you're trying to compete with something that you don't have the resources for. So if we think with imagination about, we live in this age of podcasts and like what we're doing right now. And if this is only experience people have for church, you can't replace prayer. You can't replace walking with people. You can't replace shared life. And I think people's imagination of what it means to be the people of God has expanded than trying to copy someone else's mode of church. I think that's been a gift as well.
Yeah, I think the smoke machine didn't do it, didn't it? Right. You just get a smoke machine, everything will be great, and yeah, the anointing will come and everything, you know, people will fall to their feet and give their life to Jesus, but it doesn't work that way, does it? So
we all want the shortcut, don't we?
We do. Yep, yeah, the silver bullet, if we can just mimic someone else and it worked there, but every context is different.
Yeah.
I love what you said, those words you used a moment ago, shared life. I know they're really important for you at City Life, Casey. And so how does that work for you in terms of fostering shared life in a church which is, you know, even your campus now is, you know, sort of 800 people or something? How do you foster shared life in a group that's so big?
Yeah, I think you've got to feel small all the time. So even though the weekend we're up to like the sort of 600 to 800, depending on the weekend, I think we think all the time what are ways we can feel small and share moments and meals and life. So whether it's coffee after the service or whether it's praying for newborn babies and we have the prophetic team give words and write words out. Recently we did 5 dedications and each of those families brought 30 or 50 people, and then we just got around and huddled around each of the babies and words were written out for them. That feels really small, like they're known by name. I think we think through every ministry, how does it feel small to be on a team? How does it feel small to have people in your home? You know, we just got we had 40 couples that were getting married, had either just got married or were getting married, and we matched them with 20 couples that were mature married, and they met in each other's home once a month. And there's a beautiful mentoring thing going on there that you can't get in a service. Mm. If you're interested in lots of those things, I think you can feel small no matter how big the weekend is.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of research recently around millennials and what makes a resilient disciple. And I think one of the things that showed up for resilient disciples was intergenerational relationships.
Yeah.
And what you just described is getting older people with younger people. And we always thought, I think back in the day, that, oh yeah, the younger people will learn from the older people. But it's actually a two-way street. And the older people now, I think particularly with the rise of technology and things like that, the older people learn a lot from the younger people as well. So it's kind of like a 360-degree kind of discipleship thing rather than just top-down, which is great.
And it's the rich relationship. So people who are sitting in one section may never talk to the person sitting up the back, but if they're in a lounge room and they're talking about marriage, conflict resolution, sex, money management, I mean, all of those things, all of a sudden you're sharing a meal and you're getting that cross-pollination. I agree totally.
And it's organic too.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus was always around food, wasn't he?
With
his disciples and others. And that's, you know, you're relaxed. You're enjoying each other's company. There's a sense of fellowship. You're enjoying the food. And when you can get in that sort of comfortable posture, I think the conversation goes a lot deeper than if you're sitting in a boardroom or you're sitting in a meeting room or something like that.
And what you hope for is the relationship. So when someone does have crisis or they're trying to get advice about having kids, they'll go back to one of those relationships and invite them out for dinner. And then it isn't organised all by the church, but there's something that's in the bank in terms of relational equity.
It's journey, isn't it? It's not a once off, I go and heard what I needed to hear and then I moved on. It's like, no, there's a person I can keep connecting with. And that's one of the things I love about our friendship is that we meet up, you know, at least once a month and we sit and have coffee for a couple of hours and talk about life and obviously ministry and faith and all those things. And it's iron sharpens iron. And it's not, I need to catch up with Kim and get everything out of him today because I know next month there's going to be another opportunity. And I think most of the stuff I know I learned from you. So it's it's been
I've stolen all your best stuff.
Well, there's not much of it, mate. that won't take you very far. So hopefully some more stuff will come out of the podcast today that you can use. So coming back to the missional movement, there were some real positives there that shifted the church as a whole and I think really kind of infiltrated that traditional style of church, and that's a positive thing. But some feel like maybe the pendulum swung a bit too far for a while there and it went past the healthy and then it sort of just became about kind of dropping bombs on the traditional church, if you want to use that language, which wasn't maybe as helpful as what it could be. And I think, you know, some of those missional voices are very powerful and they're very needed in the church. But I think sometimes they lose credibility and they lose a platform because of that constant real bashing and negativity. Would you agree with that? And if so, why do you think it had to go there?
I think some of the difficulty with the prophetic, if we use the Ephesians 4 apest, so the apostle, prophet, evangelist, shepherd, teacher, I think when you move prophetically and you critique and you you get given quite a large microphone, whether you're an author or a speaker, I think sometimes, you know, the prophetic nature of those personalities is to critique, and I think sometimes they can go too far. And I think in the thing I've appreciated about the movement is growing up into an apostolic movement. So I think initially the loudest voices were prophetic, and the examples they had were very small, fragile examples. So I often use the phrase now, you can be missional without being fragile. There's nothing wrong with small. I totally love small churches. I think God uses all kinds, small house churches. But I think when you become
prescriptive.
Yeah, when you say it has to be a house church or it has to be 20 people on a Thursday night in a pub, what do you do when you have kids? And I think, what do you do when you have teenagers? How do you run a youth group? It wasn't long-term practical. And the ideology is still valid, I think, but I think some of the examples of a sort of an 18 to 25-year-old meeting in a cafe or a restaurant or a pub was for a season. And they were trying to place that examples or tell pastors that had 100-year-old church with 50 people that you need to move in a pub and sell your building. That's just not practical.
Yeah.
And so I think that conversation had to grow up. And I think I've said to my peers that some of it was a bit angry. It was premature. They were trying to use their examples or trying to work it out. There wasn't a lot written in the 90s. Mm. So if you think about the examples they had were very small and minute, and they weren't multi-generational or multicultural congregations. They were very small and fragile, and they were good for their time, but I think some of it was very unhelpful.
Mm. So you used a statement before about how it's matured. It went from something to something. Can you say that again for us?
Yeah, I think the conversation started as a prophetic one. The church needs to be outward. It had forgotten its impulse of mission or being sent. The Missio Dei, the Latin word for God, is a sent God. I think that was really timely, but it can't live in the prophetic. It has to grow into a teaching, pastoral, evangelistic, apostolic movement. And that's what it's done. I look now globally, Forge is now a global organization. It's in 8 countries. It's predominantly a church planting organization. Or in America, which has lots of churches, it's a mobilizing of the mum and the mechanic or the artist and the accountant. So the average person can be on mission. It isn't just for people who are sent overseas. Missionary has been adopted by the American church, the idea that we are sent to our neighborhood, that has become a helpful conversation. I see it as an apostolic conversation. Mm-hmm. How do we send people and equip them? Yep. That's a different thing to critiquing. Ash Barker once said to me, the best critique of the bad is the practice of the good. Mm-hmm. If you're only defined by, we don't meet on a Sunday morning, when do you meet? Thursday night, why? Because it's not Sunday. That's not helpful. Yep. That won't last.
Yep.
But if you're practicing leading people to Jesus, being in a neighborhood presence, this is the rediscover of neighborhood, and there's something about place that I think is very powerful. Again, it doesn't have to look only like a veggie garden in a neighborhood. It can look in lots of different ways. If it's universal and it's a God-given principle, I think it can be used in any context.
Yeah, I think because Thursday becomes Sunday, doesn't it? If it's the new Sunday, then Thursday becomes the ritual. And just I was in the UK this year, actually, and went to Ange and Ash Barker's place. And it was just really wonderful to see what they were doing in a pretty rough neighborhood. And they had people gathering in there for meals, and they had this sort of big tent kind of thing in the front yard, and they had this worship service, and there was like a Muslim lady there, and there was all these people coming to hear the gospel. Obviously very different views, but they, through relationship, it opened up conversations. And I got to walk their llamas through the streets of were they Manchester or something? Were they Birmingham?
Birmingham.
Walking llamas through the street, which was a bit of a highlight. They didn't spit at me or anything, so that was nice. But it was just great to see how they weren't just replicating something they'd seen somewhere. They'd moved into the community, they'd listened to people, and they'd started something that was meeting needs. I think they're sort of moving into education in schools and different things like that. And it was really wonderful to see how they contextualized, because they were overseas, obviously in slums for a lot of years.
Yeah.
But coming to Birmingham, they had to think a little bit differently about what that community needed and how they could be a faithful presence there. So really inspiring to see how they've had an impact in a new community so quickly.
This is my experience of the American church. I'll just talk about that now. I think so for me, going from Australia, which was very Aussie, very tall poppy, cut down, that's Australian knockabout kind of culture, taking all of those principles to the American church for 5 years. I was in a mega church, 10,000 people, 14 sites in Chicago, Dave Ferguson's church, and just presenting very simply the Jesus of the Gospels. And Americans are like, tell me more. They don't have that kind of knockabout cynicism.
Yeah, well,
they want to be equipped. So they took the message, the missional message, and they just said, how do we do it? How do we apply it? Would this totally make sense? And so all of a sudden it just went like a sneeze, like a virus across America, because all that cynicism dropped off. And if you're an Aussie in America, they love you. They all think we're Russell Crowe.
Yep.
I have a 20% look increase in terms of good lookingness, and they love our accent.
Yep.
And so they were really leaning in. So you say, get to know your neighborhood, and they take notes, get to know your neighborhood. And you're like, are you teasing me? They're like, no, this is great. It's like they knew how to do church on steroids in terms of the slick stuff better than us. But we would often say to the American church, we're your future. I've come from a DeLorean back to you. You are losing the American being the church being at the center.
Mm.
And smart pastors know it. They know that they can do in the South a family church, but they can't do that in New York. They can't do that in San Francisco. They can do that in North Carolina, in Raleigh, in the university town. It's different to the rest of the North Carolina. It's different. It's the methods that worked in some places don't always transfer over. So they're opening and leaning in.
Yep. Yeah, it was interesting. I was at a conference the other day with Alan Hirsch speaking, and he was just come back from Europe, and he was saying, if we don't change things and you want to know what it's going to look like in, 10, 20, 50 years, look at Europe, because that's where it's heading. So he was really talking about the importance of reimagining and being innovative and thinking about how do we actually change with our culture. We don't change the message, obviously, but how do we keep contextualizing to reach people with the gospel? And I think, like you said, good pastors and practitioners will be always thinking, okay, what's the best way to reach people? And what's always worked may not work going to the future.
So. It is. I spent 6 months in Scotland. I was just recently in Sweden with the Vineyard Church, and there is a real hunger for church planting. And they realize that so many of their buildings are empty and become art galleries and nightclubs. And they remember the time when they were the peak of Christianity. That's where Western Christianity was birthed.
Yeah, very interesting. And it's sad to see it's gone that way, but it gives us an opportunity to reimagine and seek God and the leading of the Holy Spirit on what do we need to do now to actually reach people in today's culture. So it's a good challenge for us moving forward, I think. So you've come full circle now to be a pastor at a growing campus of a mega church, really, City Life's one of the biggest churches, certainly in Victoria, probably Australia as well. And so that's quite a journey. I imagine there's been some adaption for you coming out of kind of more of a missional movement into a more of a mega movement. So what are some of the things that you've had to adapt to move into that environment? And what sort of mindset shifts have you had to have or to make to step back into the big church world?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I've been at Sila 5 years now. I spent 5 years in America at a mega church. So I've had 10 years back in the mega church. So in my 25, I planted a house church movement, met once a month, it was fragile, it was tiny. We met in a pub, did all those things that the early 90s did. Ours was 2001. And then coming to, I did a 5-year apprenticeship in America. And then coming into Sea Life, realizing there's lots of need in the congregation that you can't ignore it. There has to be lots of pastoral visits. I have a full-time associate who does lots of care. And there's an increase in Australia and I think in the West of domestic violence and people's needs, just lots of needs.
Anxiety and stuff as well.
All of that.
Mental health.
You can't just say there's 10 of us meeting in a pub on a Thursday night, but you have to have good small group systems and good pastoral care and much more awareness around domestic violence and drug and alcohol addiction. I think the weekly service of how do we usher people into the presence of God, having a good experience that people see the word open, a good experience of prayer and worship, that's all very important for the gathering part so that we can scatter them well.
Yeah, so that's a big adaptation for you. Do your friends in the missional movement see you as a bit of a sellout? Or you?
Yeah, I feel kind of caught between two worlds, right? I'm a bit of a sellout to the missional guys because I'm at the big church and I'm harping on about the community all the time. And so I kind of don't fit on either. Maybe I fit both really well. Yeah. It's kind of an unusual place because I think the thing that's grown Casey is because we have such a heart for the community. And I think we've put that in front of the congregation as often as we can.
Yep.
You know, in lots of different arenas.
Yeah, so how do you think big church, I don't know if the term is good, but big church and the missional movement principles, how can they coexist and how have you seen that happen at City Life? And what can the missional movement offer the traditional church and what can the traditional church offer the missional movement? I think it can be a two-way relationship. So what would you say about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I've never tampered with the weekend. I think in terms of, except through the hosting and storytelling, I think people want authenticity. I think the days of the mega church pastor who has it all together in the perfect family and the perfect house and the perfect set of teeth, you know, is gone. People, I came from quite an abused background. I had three dads. The amount of people that tell me that they are so appreciative of my story. And I share it very authentically and real, not all the time where it's appropriate. But I think being real from the stage and who what you see on stage is what you get in the congregation, people have really appreciated. I think the missional movement, the fact that we constantly remind people that we are for the kingdom of God, and His kingdom is near and now. And what does it mean to be a faithful presence in Berwick High School and in Gatehouse among young women who are exploited? There's something about the church as a collective caring about that stuff. And you so realize there's so many churches that that's not the first thing out of their mouth or all that's so important to them. And I think I've brought all the missional stuff with me to say we as a congregation need to be known, not just what we say, but what we do that cares deeply about people who are suffering from drug and alcohol addiction or domestic violence or people who are so broken just that everyone has a seat at the table. It's easy to say, but how do you live that out? How do you allow the woman with mental illness to come in and be safe and for other people to feel safe and that everyone's kind of equal? It's the woman with the issue of blood and Jairus. They are truly brothers and sisters. The mega church or the large church can give birth to a lot of the missional stuff and give it leadership and protection and covering and resources.
And help with a bit of that fragility because they're often fragile.
So yeah. Give it oversight and leadership. And so we're really open to planning some social enterprises and some smaller things alongside starting new sites. I think we'll do both. City Life is embracing the idea of being a missional movement. And that's about church planting. And some will be large and some will be small and we'll accept both. And both are valid. That's been a 5-year journey. But I'm really excited that City Life could embrace some smaller, fragile things that would be. And I think this is about having life groups. A lot of the stuff that we pushed in the missional movement can be done through a life group. A life group can practice a rhythm of bless, beginning with prayer, listening to where they're sent, eating with people, serving them, and then sharing the story of the gospel. Those rhythms, whether done in a missional community of 50 to 80 or done in a house church or a life group, a missional life group, is just the same. So I see both.
Yeah, for sure. So you just mentioned Bless a moment ago. I know that's been a big thing for me. I think that came from Chicago with Dave Ferguson. So I think for those listening today, they might be hearing this conversation and think, yeah, well, this is all good, but how do I do it? How do I actually live on mission every day without getting, you know, a lot of Christians get caught in the Christian bubble where it's all just about hanging out with Christian people. Everyone agrees with what I think, and they're the only people I sort of rub shoulders with. I drive home, I press the garage door, I drive in, I press the button down, I go in home. I don't interact with my neighbours anymore. So what are some things you've done, and what are some helpful, I guess, and practical tips for people listening on how to actually live missionally every day?
So I think I grew up in the era where you memorise someone else's script, you know, whether it was the four spiritual laws or the two ways to live, and they're all helpful tools. Don't hear me say they're not. But I think the average Aussie has increasingly got a gap between them and the world. And so those things, they're just not done anymore. No one just inserts them into an awkward conversation with their neighbour that they don't even talk to. They may mow the lawn to that invisible line and then stop. They're not going to start to insert those conversations. When we have a paradigm shift that I'm going to begin with praying for my neighbourhood, where I pump gas, put petrol in the car, go to the same gym. If I pray all the time and say, God, I want to join you at work, that's beginning with prayer. That's the blessed rhythm. It's a rhythm, not a program. If we can create some habits and rhythms in our life that we're going to, and most of us go to the same gym, most of us go to the same coffee house, but we don't look with spiritual eyes and ask the question, God, we don't pray and believe that God will give us an opportunity. Mm. I've had hundreds of these stories where I've gone to the same cafe and then I had one of the waitresses say to me, are you a Christian? And I got to share Jesus with her because I'd been there, learnt her name, got to know the cafe. Be generous. I think if we listen, which is the L, and we really genuinely take an interest, it isn't just about me inserting a script, but actually asking. I often ask people about the tattoos that they have. Now, 9 out of 10 times, they'll tell you. 1 out of 10, they'll be like, I was drunk in Bali.
I spelled the word wrong.
That's right. Chinese word for love, and it means something else. Yeah. But 9 out of 10 times is this incredibly rich story about their life and how they lost a loved one or they were in a relationship. And if we listen and pay attention, and then if we eat with people, eating's about making level ground. If people can at least ask someone for a meal or be open to having a barbecue or something, you'll get to serve them. Most of the time we go straight to serve. We think, what can I do that will get me a transactional conversation? Mm-hmm. But if we pray for people, listen to them, eat them, they become our friends. Yeah. And maybe our friends, then we can actually get a chance to share the story, our story. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this over and over and over again, where if people practice healthy rhythms, God is at work. That's the thing the missional conversation said. God is at work. When we sleep, he never sleeps. He's wooing people all the time to himself. Yeah. I think the church has forgotten that. It doesn't believe that.
So it's that idea that God's at work. How do we join him in what he's doing?
That's
so
right.
It's not reinventing something new or pioneering, you know, a mission, you know, like God's already at work. And so where is he working and how can we join with that? So I think that's really helpful. I love what you said about Bless not being a program but a rhythm. So for those that are listening and you're not quite sure, Bless is begin with prayer, listen to people, eat with people, which is what Jesus did all the time around food, serve, and then share your story. And yeah, I think it's great. I love Proverbs 18, verse 16. It says that the gift opens up the way for the giver and ushers them into the presence of the great. And I think often the gift is all those things you just talked about, beginning with prayer, praying for people, listening to them, eating with them, serving them. And I know for us as a church at Follow, like the serving has really opened up opportunities that wouldn't have been there if we didn't serve. And it's ushered us into the presence of the great, which of course is Jesus the King. You know, like we're in his presence and we're joining him in his work. And that's where you get credibility, you get relational buy-in, and that's where the opportunities come to share the story. So there's some people I know that just haven't got the shift. And so they still think, you know, you're selling out if you're not standing on a soapbox with a tract in your hand and yelling at people about heaven and hell. But what they don't realise is that we're not in Kansas anymore. You know, it's a very post-Christian kind of culture. And what may have worked, you know, when Billy Graham was doing his big meetings probably doesn't work as much anymore. And there's still gifted evangelists who are great on the street and that's great if they're, but most people aren't gifted that way.
That's right.
And if they try to do it, they're forcing something unnatural, they're potentially offending people and they're actually putting up a barrier rather than inviting people in. And so that's where I think the blessed rhythm's a really good one because it's investing over a long period of time. It's not that get saved mentality that know, I want you to give your life to Jesus today. And if you don't, I'll move on to someone else and I'll forget about you. It's like, no, I'm in this long term. We're in the same cafe, we're at the same gym, we meet at the same kinder with the parents, and I'm going to keep journeying with you and through relationship. Whether you give your life to Jesus or not, I'm investing in this relationship because I love you and you're creating the image of God. And I think that's a big shift that most Christians have been able to make. Some still haven't, unfortunately. So
I think it's proximity, not and it's not treating people like a project.
Yeah.
It's saying God has placed me in this house. It's not an accident I live here. And if God's involved, then I'm going to act like the kingdom's coming versus, I think, especially Pentecostals, we grew up with a eschatology that said Jesus is coming soon. Let's close our eyes and just hope we can get as many people to the rally who then someone else will preach to them. I'm let off the hook. Thank goodness I'm not an evangelist.
Here he comes, meet on the hill. He's coming today.
And I think we've made these words in Ephesians like a big E. People think, I can't be Billy Graham. I've never preached. 99.9% of people will never preach in a stadium, but they have the gift. I say to people all the time, you have a gift of evangelism. They say, no, I don't. I say, yes, you do. You are a person of peace. You bring peace. You know how to speak to people. You're a good listener. Hugh Holter often says the best evangelists are introverts because they're great listeners. Mm-hmm. They don't want to talk all the time. So I think some of this is reframing how we see some of these things.
Yeah, something I heard recently, which I really agree with, is that authenticity is the currency of leadership these days. I think lost a lot of trust in the community and all that sort of stuff. So people want to see someone who's real, but I think it's also the currency of friendship.
Mm.
You know, we can fake it till we make it, but people aren't attracted to that kind of person. So I think as we're vulnerable and authentic with one another and with people who don't know Jesus, I think people are strangely attracted to that and go, yeah, I want that.
I think we're a bit... I know my generation, I'm 45, we're a bit tired of the pastor who has the affair and we're all shocked and we can't believe how they have all this hidden stuff.
Mm.
If we live authentic lives, then we are being broken vessels that are healed by Jesus. Mm. And I think people relate to that. It's not this ivory tower speaking down to people. I just don't think that's what people are looking for, and it's a gospel message.
Yeah, and like you said, most people don't grow up and say, today I'm going to have an affair. It's bit by bit over a period of time, and when it's all hidden and I'm going through this myself and I don't know, you know, anyone else who's gone through it and all that sort of thinking, which is really wrong, when we're not confessing and repenting and being honest with one another, those things just sort of all build up, and then before you know it, someone's having an affair, but it didn't just happen that day. It's years of not actually journeying with people in relationship, and that's where it's so important to be accountable, to be an open book, to be transparent. I think those things are really important.
It's the shared life, what you talked about before. I grew up in the era where the pastor said leadership's lonely. Mm. And they kind of, Bible college talked about that, like you're not going to have any friends. Mm. Ministry sounded awful. Yeah. And in the early years, it was a little bit like that. Like once you became a pastor, you're different to your friends. Where I think ministry lived in shared life community, that's a witness how we treat our friends and our kids, and my friends know my kids and I know their kids. And there's a sense of growing up as what I call covenantal community.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's really true. I think some of those things can become self-fulfilling prophecies. Our ministry is going to be lonely, and so we just start living that out.
Yeah, it's so true.
We can actually create a different path forward, you know, that doesn't have to be lonely. And that's what I love with our friendship is that, we could sit around by ourselves and say, oh, ministry is really lonely. And there's times when it does feel lonely. Let's just be honest about that. But in those times, we can reach out to one another and others as well in our lives. And it doesn't have to be that self-fulfilling prophecy. It can be something very different. And like you said a moment ago, we model something for future generations that go, hey, well, people have always said ministry has to be lonely, but I look at these guys and they got friends and they're journeying with people, and that's a really powerful witness.
I think, you and I are a good example of we could be competitors. We're not far from each other. Mm. We've had people from Sea Life go to Follow and from Follow to Sea Life. And I remember thinking, and you're a much better preacher than me, so I think, if we're going to be comparing goods and services, they can go and get a better message at Follow.
Maybe you're a lot funnier than I am.
Mate. That's true. That is true.
And a lot more modest, obviously. Yeah.
And I think what's been beautiful is that we genuinely love each other. You've preached in mine, church, I've preached in yours. If we were threatened by each other, you wouldn't have me preach or you wouldn't preach in mine. Mm. And I think that's the future of the kingdom of God, the way church planning needs to happen, the way ministers need to relate to each other. Yeah. We're fighting over the same small group of Christians instead of trying to reach the community.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that is a big shift, I think, I feel happening. And I was going to sort of bounce that off you in a minute, but at the BUV, we've got this Baptist Union Victoria, they've got this spectrum now. So it's a spectrum of mission. And so it starts at one end with what you're talking about before in terms of social enterprise. So starting like a missional cafe or an op shop or something like that. Then they've got this thing called placemaking where they're putting young people, doesn't even need to be young people, but people who see themselves as missionaries, and they're putting them in new housing estates. And their job there is to work with the developers and to build a sense of community with all people coming together around shared life and meals and all that sort of stuff. And then you've got the traditional sort of missional communities where you're small lounge room, real incarnational ministry in their community. Then you've got what they call more traditional church planning. So follow would be more, I don't really like the word traditional, but you know what I mean? Like you meet at a certain time, there's preaching, there's worship, and all that sort of stuff. And then you've got the existing church. And I think what the BUV have recognized, and it's a very good thing, is that all those things are valid expressions of mission. And if we're going to reach lots of people, we need broad ways of doing that. And so I think probably over the last 20 years, it's just been a lot of bomb dropping that, oh yeah, I don't like that, so I'll just criticize that. And we're just throwing bombs over the fence. I think what I've sensed changing in the last little while is there's a unity. Those walls are coming down.
Yeah.
And we're acknowledging one another. We're working together. We're celebrating the successes. We're journeying with people in the difficult times. And we're realizing just because I'm not called to start a social enterprise cafe, well, at this stage, maybe one day I will, but at this stage I don't feel, you know, a sense of doing that. I don't have to bag at someone who is. I actually want to celebrate that and say, wow, they're reaching people that I probably will never reach, and vice versa. And so I've sensed that kind of shift. Do you sense that growing unity? And if so, what do you think the possibilities are and the potential of that going forward?
Baptists do it really well. I worked for them for a year for all those reasons that you just stated. I think more cooperation around churches will help that when we cheer each other on. So if someone goes into office and opens a social enterprise or a cafe and you cheer that on, I think it will move that way as it gets harder. The climate in Australia gets harder. The research from McCracken and all of that, in terms of people love Jesus, don't love the church. The more that we can represent the kingdom and not be fighting, because people notice it. They know that when we're territorial, when we're our own brand. I think
it is.
Yeah. It gives us a bad name. I think the more cooperation, the more storytelling, the more championing, that all helps that. I think that people's imagination are being widened. Mm-hmm. It's an and, not an or.
Yeah.
I think the genius of the and is holding both of those as real models.
Mm. And I love the fact that we genuinely want to work together on different things, whether it's future church planting or even just, you know, at the moment, bushfire relief and potentially working together on something like that to actually help people in need, not as it's a follow thing or it's a city life thing, but hey, we're actually working together to see people bless and to see needs met. And I think, once again, it just doubles the witness in the community. They go, oh, wow, these are different denominations, different churches, but they actually love each other. They're actually encouraging one another and they're championing each other. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
I love that our staff have caught up. You know, we've come out to you, you've come out to us. They've caught up other times. They're trading secrets. It's great. There shouldn't be any hoarding. If we've got a good idea, if you've got a good idea. I remember bringing my staff down to the food van and I was so inspired. And this is what I think we could do for each other, is to help champion. And we'd learn, you know, you put the truck together, all the hard ways you said, and you got better at it.
Yep.
You know?
It's now sustainable.
Yes.
It's good.
Yeah, it's really good.
There's no copyright in the kingdom, is there?
No, that's right.
There's nothing new under the sun.
We all plagiarise each other.
Yeah, we do. So I think the more you can share, the more impact we'll have in our own context and together. So, yeah, I'm really excited about the possibilities that could be birthed from those sorts of partnerships. So we'll go back a little bit to the US. You were talking about, you know, you spent quite a bit of time in the US and you touched on that before, and you love US culture. I've been to your house. It's kind of like there's all that memorabilia and, you know, the NBA stuff and the Jordans up there.
Sneakers.
And all that. Sneakers, yeah. I think you've got about a million pairs of Jordans, probably every Jordan right up until whatever they're up to now. What do you love most about American culture?
I love that they're a can-do. There's such
a. I love that too. It's awesome, isn't it? Yeah.
I go back once a year to feel better about myself.
Yep.
They're so, there's such a, I believe in you. You can do it. If you've got this idea, they absolutely back it. I love that the church, they really are entrepreneur. They're very generous. Very generous people. They're incredibly wide-eyed dreamers. They're great entrepreneurs. So is Australians, you know, for other reasons. You know, we are a little bit more the tall poppy, but we'd love to have a crack at things. We've got some amazing entrepreneurs, just different.
The battler. We're more the battler, aren't we?
We are.
Against the odds, you know, the smaller country, the... You know, we're gonna do it despite the odds, and I think that's a wonderful thing about Australian culture. So, what would you say the main differences are between US culture and Australian culture?
I mean, we were founded by convicts, so we have that. I often say that when I explain to Americans that we're different. I often say Aussies are founded by convicts, so yeah, we have that
it's in the DNA.
It is. It really is. Ned Kelly. He's like the what's that new Star Wars Mandalorian, you know?
Yeah, well, I don't like Star Wars. I don't know what you're talking about. But yeah. If I was a sci-fi person, I'd be nodding my head.
Yeah, all the sci-fi lovers will know what I'm talking about. You know, we love Ned Kelly as one of our heroes. I think the Americans, they were born in revolution.
Yep.
So that pioneering, put a stake in the ground, the Irish, you know, running a far and away, you know.
USA. Yes. They will save the world.
Yeah, and there is a national pride that can get them into trouble, but there is a humble beginnings. If you go to the Midwest, I think we were talking about this before, America is not one state. Like, it's not like from New York to San Francisco and everyone is the same. They are kind of made up of seven countries that were migrated there, the Dutch, the Irish, the Italians, you know, lots of different countries. And so you go to the South and it's completely different to a Midwestern Chicago person. Mm. And I love that about them, you know. I love that they're very warm and friendly, hospitable people. I love that their churches are leaning into the missional conversation. You know, they are the original megachurch place and multi-site that came out of all of that. They're ahead of us in some of that technology, and yet they're all behind us and they're willing to learn. They're very good learners.
Mm. So what do you think of all the things you learn in the US? What's the thing that you learned the most about the church and culture from US?
Yeah, I would say I was really blessed to be on Dave Ferguson's team, and I would say the spirit of reproducing, multiplication and movement, the idea that I see in you, call out that greatness, and then I do, you watch, we talk, and then I do, you help, we talk, and then you do, I help, we talk, and then you do, I watch, and then you go do it with somebody else. They embody that. Mm. I moved to America in 2009. I was teaching a summer. I got there in December, and in January I was teaching a class. And the first question that one of the staff members said to me is, who are you going to apprentice? Mm. And I remember saying, I don't even know all the staff's names. I just moved here. But right in their DNA is – every person needs to be an apprentice. Every person can lead a life group or lead a ministry. That I've caught that. That just bleeds from me now. Mm. The book Hero Maker that Dave writes, I've been going through it with our life group leaders and staff. It's very powerful, the idea that you believe. You make. They're very good at this, especially the church I was in, Chicago. Don't make ministry about you. Don't be the hero. Be a hero maker. Mm. That stuff is, it's with me forever.
Yep. And it's so important, isn't it, when the church is sort of hemorrhaging a little bit in Australia. I think that idea of multiplication, if we're going to continue to thrive and be effective, we need to keep reproducing people, and we need to keep – it's discipleship really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, totally.
I think the beautiful thing about Hero Maker is the simplicity of it. It's like it's so simple and yet so profound, and the hard thing is actually living it and seeing that multiplication happen so that new people are coming in ministry and just in life as missionaries in their context.
I can remember, Luke, being annoyed when I first heard it when I went there because it's so simple. Mm. Yet you realise that you need to have complex ideas on one side of a coin that are simply presented on the other. Mm. The I do, you watch is so simple. Yeah. And so John Maxwell talked to it. It's nothing new. Yeah. But they've been able to coin it in a way that really has the flywheel of apprenticeship working. Mm. And see, like, we have a phrase called co-leaders. And I've been talking to the guy in charge of life groups and saying to him, it's not a great phrase. So when you be my co-leader of my life group, the idea of inviting people into apprentice is to watch and learn and debrief. I think apprenticeship is a good word. Yeah. And they have it in their language. They're very good at language and building culture. We know that language builds culture.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think just finding that language that's helpful in your context is just, it's critical. When you're casting vision, when you're trying to get people to grab hold of a concept, if you can find that, you know, reproducible, memorable language,
yeah,
that's where. And I think the true test is if people start repeating the language back to you, you know that, yeah, they've got it. and now they're sharing it with others. It's great.
That's had the biggest effect on me. So I would say we use this phrase, we're a kitchen, all the time.
Yep.
And you hear people talk about it, we're a kitchen, we're a kitchen. Compared to a restaurant where you come and you eat, you pay a fee and you critique the meal, it was a bit too salty or it was a, you know, it wasn't cooked well enough. And
three
then,
stars.
Yes. And then you do a Yelp review. Where a kitchen is this image that we all contribute. Not everyone can cook. Not everyone can lead worship. Not everyone can preach. But you can sit at the table. You can help get ready. We can all bring this meal together. It's a beautiful image.
Mm, it
and it's become kind of something that's really – we even got little spoons, you know, like a cooking one, not a silver one, like a made of
wood.
Wooden
spoon, yeah.
A wooden spoon. We shared meals, shared moments, shared life on it. It's this image of a kitchen. I think these things I got from America, they're sort of ingrained in me now.
Mm, I like that wooden spoon. I think that could redeem my thinking around wooden spoons because the last time I remember them was on my backside growing up. So, yeah, maybe we could redeem that as well. There'd be good. I'll give one to my mum and say, hey, you remember this? And we're redeeming it for more useful purposes now. So that's really good, mate. That's great. So on this podcast, we really want to talk about practical things for people, but also dig into some of those things that are a bit raw and difficult. And I know you've been through some really difficult stuff in life, and some of that happened when you're in the US, particularly around cancer. You went through a cancer battle yourself, and what made that extraordinarily hard and even harder than what it would be. It's already really hard going through it as an individual, but your son Carter was going through a similar battle at the same time. Do you want to tell us a bit about that time, how it all came about and what it was like going through that?
Yeah, so we moved to America in 2009 in December, and 4 weeks later Carter was diagnosed with leukemia, and we moved to Chicago. We didn't know a soul. We'd literally just met Dave 6 months before. We brought him out to Australia. So we didn't have any lifelong friends. We didn't have family, and it was a real defining moment of where we called over here, because I remember being in the hospital and thinking, that's it, this is all over, we're going home. And we're literally, my sons were 5, 7, and 9, so Carter was 7 years old. And he started to look off, and actually a nurse said, you need to take him to a doctor. And I remember my wife coming home, she'd just been to the doctor, got some blood tests, and said, can I go home to get the results, took an hour to get the blood results. And the phone rang as she answered, as she came to the front door. We were staying in a basement, and her face just dropped, and the doctor said, get him straight to a hospital. We didn't even wait for an ambulance. We drove into the city. They put him on a Guernsey, and then got these doctors telling us that he's got leukemia. If he doesn't get immediate blood transfusion, he's going to die. It was terrifying. I just bawled my eyes out. I think I cried every day for a year. Watched his hair fall out, watched his kidneys shut down, watched him scream in pain as they put a needle in his spine every month to give an injection of chemo, because they found kids, if they didn't inject into the spine, there's blood in there, they would often get spinal cancer. So you just see these very sick, and you're in a hospital filled with kids who are dying and who are sick. So talk about a crisis of faith. I'll never forget the moment we decided to stay. I thought in my head we were leaving to come back to Australia. Free healthcare, not free there. We just barely inked the contract for health insurance from the church. And I can remember my wife and I were sitting at the end of the bed, and my oldest boy, who was 9, came into the room and he held both her hands. He said, we're going to stay, aren't we, Dad? Carter, if we're meant to go home, Carter would have got cancer in Australia. Mm-hmm. And I was just bawling my eyes out looking at my wife, and she just nodded her head. And from that moment, we never talked about coming home. Mm-hmm. And a doctor walked into the room and he said, I'm the head of oncology. You'll probably never meet me again. You're probably thinking of going home. Don't. This is as good a hospital as any you'll get in Australia. And that kind of confirmed it for us. And so we made the really brave decision to stay. He went through 4 years of chemo. His hair fell out twice. His kidneys shut down. Every 10 days he would have to take steroids. And steroids is everything you think it is. It makes them really quite large, really hungry, really angry, quite agitated. So he would eat all the cereal from the cupboard and was just out of control for about 2 or 3 days. We'd wait for it to go out of his system, and then our little boy would come back to us. And it was really hard because I had no sick leave. My wife would have to go to hospital by herself every week initially. The church was amazing. They just, it's different when you know people. Someone asked me recently, was it weird to do it all overseas? It was, because, you know, family did come and visit us, and obviously people were shocked. So he went through 4 years of chemo. We were only going to go for 2 years. And then every year we extended it. And then we were thinking of coming home. And he asked us, he said, "Mum and Dad, I want to have an experience of living in America without being sick." And so we said, let's do a fifth year. He finished in April. And we took him to Disney World in September. Maria's family flew over. And then I began to feel sick. And then we got the news that I had leukemia as well.
Yeah, so my son Lenny was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 3, so he's just turned 7. So it's been about 4 years, and my wife's been through open heart surgery just recently when she was younger, and we'll need to have that again. And people often ask me about it and you know, how you're going and stuff, and I often say, I wish it was me. You know, I wish it was me going through it, because it sort of breaks your heart when, you know, people you love so much are going through a difficult time. So thinking back to your story and what you went through, you probably had similar thoughts, but then it was you. And so you've got both of this, you know, you've got your son who's gone through it and going through it, and now you're going through it as well. What was that like for you?
Yeah, look, it was, we never blamed God. You know, I've met so many people with sickness. When you have cancer, it kind of brings you into a community of people. Obviously, lots of people lose loved ones to cancer. I was saying to my wife the other day, what a miracle, Carter and I are both alive. But I've met a lot of angry people, very angry at God. And Maria and I was very proud of the fact that we had a very healthy, robust theology. We didn't think God gave our kid cancer. Lots of people told us that. Christians say dumb, stupid, hurtful things.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure you've experienced lots of it. I know when I got sick, I even had a pastor, quite a good friend of mine's dad, say to me, "Did you ever pray that you'd take it? That's why you got cancer." As if God's in heaven waiting for me to be like saying that, you know, oh gosh, it's unfair. Oh, Kim said the words, just give him cancer.
Gotcha. Surprise. Yeah.
It's just a bad theology of who God is. I know it was hard for my wife when I got sick, because she felt that was unfair. Like, it was really difficult to think. And she's an amazing woman. She'll have a mansion in heaven. She cared for Carter and then me. And it was, I was really sick. He had a very common childhood leukemia. He was sick. It was over 4 years. It was long. I had a very deadly form of leukemia called AML, which if not immediately treated, you die from. I was in isolation for 6 weeks. I had 28 blood transfusions. I couldn't walk. I was had an atrophy of the feet. It was hard. It was hard. And I think the church by then, we had friends. So people were just so shocked that you go through this 4 years of chemo with a kid and then you get it. People couldn't comprehend it. And I remember the first 6 weeks as a blur. It was such a really low hemoglobin in my oxygen to my blood. And the doctors are like, "How are you walking around?" And I was like, "Barely. I was out of breath. I thought I just had pneumonia." And my wife was actually quite mean to me. We went to get a chest scan. And once a kid had, you know, this one's like Lenny goes through all this stuff, you know, anything else, less of a broken arm, you're like, "You're all right. Put a Band-Aid on it." So I was like, "Oh, I feel so tired. I think I need to get in the wheelchair." And she was like, "Whatever. We'll be along." And then she tipped me out of it at the last bit to walk, because she didn't want me being a sook. I am a bit of a sook. And she was amazing. I from the moment I was admitted, she came and stayed with me and really looked after me. And I felt like it brought us together. I don't know how people do this without a faith. I watch people, they say money and sickness tears marriages apart. And I watch lots of people fight each other and get angry for no, you know, of course, good reasons. But it brought us to quite close together through this.
Yeah, I often think the same. Without a faith, I don't know how people get through it, and the truth is they often don't. They end up breaking up or whatever. So it's beautiful to hear that that brought you together. So take us to the darkest days. Can you think of like some of the darkest moments you had? And obviously you were saying you didn't doubt God or blame God, but what were you thinking in those really dark days?
I mean, I can remember this one night lying in hospital and I was journaled and I said, "God, please, I don't want to leave Maria a widow. I don't want to leave the boys without a father." I just wept and wept, and I actually had written a book, and I couldn't tour the book. And I remember thinking, ministry, platform, fame, none of that matters compared to health and family, and just laid, just surrendered all that stuff. It was dark. I was really sick, and I can just remember just feeling God's presence in the midst of all this pain and angst. And because when you're lying in the hospital 6 weeks, not knowing if you're going to recover, keep getting blood transfusions, feeling just awful. It was, I wasn't myself. I'm a very outgoing, bubbly person. I just didn't want to talk to anybody. Felt very depressed. And probably at that moment, just surrendering everything, just saying, God, you have to meet me. And it was kind of a funny story. I wrote this book, I couldn't tour it. And if you know anything about authoring a book, you have to get out on the circuit in America, especially in America, the radio stations and the churches. And all my friends who are quite, I'm Bollywood famous, group of Indians like me. I have a lot of famous Hollywood friends.
You like Brett Lee.
Yeah. A bunch of my friends all promoted the book on the same day to buy. And people don't, authors are funny about, they all, everyone wants you to promote their book, but there's a bit of, did you promote mine? And there's a bit of that in the industry. But because I was sick, everyone, so for one day, it was in the top 100 books in Amazon. It was sold more copies than The Shed. And all these women, all these people rang up the church and said, who's this Asian woman, Kim Hammond? And how did she write such an amazing book? And to be fair, I wrote it with a pastor called Darren Cronshaw, who's a double PhD missiologist, amazing, brilliant man. He's a Baptist pastor. And I always feel sorry for Darren because all the cleverest theological parts of the book he wrote, and I just told the funny stories. And we always get quoted all over the world. It got published into Korean. Yeah. And I was in Sweden recently and this pastor asked me to sign it. And I thought, wow, a Swedish pastor has written my book. That's so mind-boggling.
You must be used to surprising people. I remember when you first contacted me to catch up and we didn't know each other and, you know, Kim Hammond's coming to see you and I'm sitting in my office and then you rocked up and I'm just completely different to what I was imagining.
You're imagining a beautiful-looking woman and not a hairy Greek Egyptian.
Absolutely. But I'm glad now. Yeah. I never thought in that moment that we'd become such great mates. So that's been a real blessing for me. So you're cancer-free now?
Yeah, I'm in remission.
Yep.
I get a once-a-year blood test to kind of make sure it stays at bay. My son's 17. He's 6'3". And got a size 13 shoe.
Yep.
And the doctors told him the chemo had stunned his growth. I said to him the other day, see, God didn't want you to be a 7-foot weird freak. You see, you're just the right height.
It's God's gift. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and in a funny way, suffering is a gift, isn't it?
Oh, you know, yeah.
I think we underestimate that sometimes as Christians, but rejoice in your sufferings. It you know, creates perseverance and character and hope. And I'm sure there's so much shaped in your life through that really dark season that's helped you going forward. So I was going to ask you a little bit about coming through that and being, you know, wrestling with the idea of life and death and, you know, am I going to come through and what's the future hold? How has that shaped your life and how has it shaped your approach to ministry as well?
Yeah, I think it's a really great question. I think if you look at faith, you go through formation, belief, faith, serving, being part of a church community. And then every Christian at some point, I think, faces a dark night of the soul, faces where they feel God is silent. You know, for me, it's given me great empathy to people's journey and also the fact that they have to go through that and how they come out of it really affects whether they'll go backwards or forward in terms of their own growing up and maturity. I meet people all the time who have had sickness and I'm able to sit and pray with them and understand them. I think it gives a greater depth in your relationship with God in terms of the times when you just journal when things are rotten. Not everything works out. That's why I can't buy into the prosperity gospel because not everything in life works out that way. It's not about a limited faith. I think one day we'll get to heaven and I'll be like, you use Tupperware? What the heck? Well, you know, I have no real, we'll not know why people get cancer. But I think I have great appreciation for God just being in those spaces, even when you can't hear him or even when you feel really broken. And my brokenness, my scars, just like Jesus took scars to heaven, I think your scars are testimonies to your healing. And so, you know, I look at the healing that we've done as a family and it's really brought our family together. And it was hard on the boys. You know, they had a sick brother who got to pick all the places we went to eat. Because when you have a sick kid, you'd understand this.
Absolutely, yep.
You know, you don't mean to favour. You're not choosing to favour. But the one kid who's saying, the doctors are saying could die, he wants to have burgers. That's, you have burgers.
Mm. And plus, they just need your attention.
Yeah.
You know, medically and all that sort of stuff. You can't just leave them for a few days and hope they're all right. You know, you need that attention all the time. So, and I think adults understand that. I think it's a stretch for kids to kind of grasp that. And they do feel like it's a little bit of favouritism. So, yeah, we've had to work hard at that in our family as well, and it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah, my youngest boy's a peacemaker, so he'd be like, whatever. It was harder for my oldest boy. He still says he never got to eat seafood in America. I'll take him back one day and let him have all the lobster he can have. But at the time, we had to choose between lobster and burgers, and Carter wanted burgers.
Yeah.
I can remember when Carter finished his last chemo, he would have been 11. We went out. We used to go to Red Robin. Red Robin was a burger place that had unlimited fries. We loved it. Mm. Big Aussie. It was the only place that did egg. I love egg on a burger, like an Aussie burger.
Yep.
I remember Carter was like, I'm so glad this was me and not you guys. I'm glad it was me that got sick and not you. And we're all just bawling our eyes out as this kid's just, in some ways they grow up so much quicker, don't they? Because they have to deal around with doctors and nurses. And other parts of their childhood is robbed.
Mm.
Probably from 7 to 11, he didn't play sport. And he didn't get to – I remember going to we took him to a theme park. I was speaking at a youth camp, and he hadn't got his port in yet. He had a pick line, and they were about to put a port in, and he could swim. And they put him on a surfboard, one of those wave make machines. And he was just so frail, it threw him right against the wall. And I remember the guy going, oh, my gosh, I've killed the kid with cancer. And like he just
– not good for the resume.
No, it's like this wave park in Wisconsin had killed my kid with cancer, you know. It kind of just flew against the wall, and it was like a little, you know. But he is an amazing kid today.
It's resilience. It really builds resilience, doesn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, whatever happens from this point forward, well, you've been through something so significant, and people prodding and poking and in hospitals and out of hospitals and feeling really sick. So I think it does develop resilience. And I've even seen it in Lenny as a seven-year-old, you know, like nothing really phases him like it would other kids because he's just used to.
Yeah, being poked and prodded.
Yeah.
I do want to say too, I have tremendous empathy, and I think there's a difference between sympathy and empathy. Brené Brown talks about sympathy is like, oh, at least you've got a kid, you know. Or,
that's helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of this distant relating, but empathy is when you climb down into the hole and sit with people. And so I recognise very clearly that not everyone has our story, that we were both in remission. I've had lots of friends lose their wife or their kid to cancer. Yeah. Cancer robs a lot of people. And so I recognise that you end up grieving for a lifetime. A good friend of mine said, you know, it stops physically hurting, but never stops emotionally hurting. Time heals, but you can't speed that stuff up. And so walking people with grief, I really have great empathy for people, especially when they lose the battle with cancer. We've got a girl in our church right now who's had a brain tumour, had it removed, it's grown back. She was in a coma, and we thought for sure she was going to pass. She woke up from the coma, gave her life, rededicated her life to Jesus, got baptised. She's up in Queensland right now. And I don't know if it's a full miracle. I don't know how much time the parents will get, but you cherish every moment. And I think some people can go the hyper faith. I've had friends who never talked about passing and unfortunately were taken and their life ended. And other people got really ready. There's something about doing this healthily and well.
Yeah.
And absolutely, you know, I'll say this too. Americans really were very generous to us. We got to go on a Make-A-Wish. We got to go to Europe. We got given an Xbox and an iPhone. Americans are so generous.
Mm.
But I can't separate the pain from the blessings. And some people have said to me, gee, I love all those blessings. But you can't actually separate them. Mm-hmm. They actually are totally enmeshed.
Mm.
And I think I don't have any regrets. Of course, I would love my son to have not gone through cancer, but I think God has used it and to his will and for his good.
Well, no doubt you'd be a different person now because of what you went through.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things that wouldn't have been shaped in you, wouldn't have developed, and perhaps we wouldn't have been the leader you are without some of that stuff. And I think those things really do shape us, and I do love that. I think you think back to those times and you think, I hated it at the time, didn't want to be going through it, but I look back now and kind of grateful that we go through some of those things because God's always at work and he's doing stuff there, and it's really wonderful. I love what you said about empathy as well. I think it's, someone told me once, it's active sympathy. So sympathy is, oh, well, that's a shame. Empathy is, that's a shame. What can I do?
Yeah.
Can I pray? Can I journey with you? Can I come and have a coffee? Can I support you in some way? And I think that's the big difference. And once again, when you've been through something, you have the ability to empathize, and it's received from the other person too because they know that you've experienced what they're going through. And I think I love that, how when you go through things in your life, God allows that to become a real platform for ministry.
Yeah.
Because you can speak into a situation with an authority that you wouldn't have if you hadn't been through it.
And for people listening, I would say, like, everyone reacts at the start and they've moved. I don't know how so many people contacted us and were worried, but soon it fades, their life moves on, and it doesn't for the person sick. You used to live with, you know, Lenny's diabetes. Like, so often I say to people, the best thing you can do is wait 6 months, 3 months, when everyone else has forgotten, and then drop a meal around. And don't wait for the people to tell you. Most people are a bit prideful. They don't want to ask for help. Mm. My wife was like that. People say, tell us if we can do anything. She's not going to ask new friends, can you cook a meal? But it was people who, you have to do it sensitively, but they forced, in some ways, they made us do a meal train, and they made us have a holiday, and they it's often, I think, 6 months or a year even, because you never stop grieving. And so often we need to think about who is affected by and what can we do down the track. Everyone responds in the first 6 weeks. Everyone sends flowers. Everyone does thing in the initial, but I think we're in this for the long-term relationship.
Yeah, often when someone has a loved one pass away, I put a reminder in my phone for 5 months later. And so when the reminder comes up, just give them a phone call. How are you going?
That's,
you
know, beautiful, Luke.
All the support has faded off, and people haven't, you know, says it is moved on with life, but you're still stuck in that, missing that person. Sometimes you're alone now because it was your husband or your wife or whatever. So just to have those people who proactively reach out is really significant. So
Carter went through 4 years of chemo, and I remember about the third year, Daryl Gardner visited us, a great pastor in New Zealand, and he said to me, everyone else has moved on, but you guys are still living this. And it was a way, on one hand, it let a bunch of our friends off the hook, because we've kind of been resenting a few people, like, how could you not see what we're going through? And at the same time, it just helped us understand we're still living with this long term. It's very helpful.
Well, I'm really grateful you came through it, mate. I think my life wouldn't be as rich as it is if we hadn't have met. So it's really clear that God wasn't finished with you yet, and he's, you know, there's plans for you. So I thought we're sort of coming to the end of the podcast. It'd be good just to talk to you a little bit about, you know, what do you see for your life for the next, say, 20 years? What's the big dream? What would you love to see happen? If you could say, you know, in 20 years you're standing there, you're looking back, and you'd feel like, that's awesome, what would it look like?
Yeah, I think for me it's being part of a church planting movement, you know, seeing churches planted all over the world, seeing missional stuff happen and kind of awakening the people of God. I want to mentor missional leaders in their movements. So I want to be, I'm an encourager. I want to encourage people to live into their dreams and mentor people and mobilize them. So for me, in 20 years, if I've been a catalyst or a coach for a bunch of church plants, a bunch of church, I love the local church. I've been the international director of Forge up until recently. I resigned as the international director, and I'm the president of the board. I think I'll always have an arm in the missional movement, but there is something about the local church. I think if I can stay connected to the local church, have local team, local friends, and just continue to see, just join God at work. And I hope my kids have kids and be a grandfather, and still married to my wife. We've got our 25th wedding anniversary in January.
Yeah, wow.
That's amazing.
Congratulations, that's great.
Yeah.
You got married when you were 10.
Yes, yeah, I know, we were children, babies. I hope that that I've helped to be a catalyst for what God is doing.
I'm 20 years in March with my wife, so.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
we must be getting older.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the grey hairs.
I was at your 40th.
Yeah, you were. That's right. Very good. So I think it's just been a great chat, mate, and You know, in terms of you being an encourager, like I can just affirm that. I think you're one of the biggest encouragements in my life. I remember I was catching up with another pastor who was telling me, we're at a cafe one day, and he was telling me how he's lonely and all that sort of stuff we were talking about before. And he said, what about you? Have you got people in your life? And I said, oh, yeah, I've got some, reeled off a few people. But I said, I hang out with Kim Hammond from City Life, and he's like my personal cheer squad. You know, if I'm feeling a bit down, I look at my diary and go, oh, that's right, I'm catching up with Kim on Friday. You know, it'll be fine. And he's always saying, you're a great leader. And all this sort of stuff. Anyway, we walked out of the cafe into the car park, and here's you and James Harrison walking up towards me. And exactly what I just told him, you did. You're like, oh, you're hanging out with Luke. Oh, he's a great leader. He's amazing. And it was like I'd, you know, texted you under the table and said, hey, come now, come now. So yeah, you live it out, mate. And that's, I think that's a real gift to the kingdom, to be someone who sees something in people and is not, you know, territorial or afraid to, you know, talk them up and encourage them is a beautiful thing. So keep that up. It's great. So we're going to finish. We always finish with some quick fire questions. So I've got three for you today. Three in one, the first question really. It goes back to your US days. I want to know your favourite NBA team, your NFL team and your baseball team.
Yeah, so you can't live in Chicago and not go for the Bears.
Yep.
I'm a Spurs fan at heart, but always will root. That's the word they use, root for the Bulls. What was the other one?
Our baseball team.
Oh, you got it. I'm a White Sox fan.
White Sox, okay.
When I got to Chicago, they told me there was only one team, the White Sox. I found out there was a whole other team called the Cubs, and they win. And they haven't. They did have that time, had not won a pennant. So yeah. They're bigger fans. They love the Cubs in Chicago.
Yeah, well, I think I saw Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam doing a video when they won the World Series or something.
They did a few years ago.
It was huge. Yeah,
there'd been a long stretch over 100 years they had not won.
Yeah, but like St Kilda, like that. Yeah,
yeah. They sacrificed a goat. And everything. Yeah.
Whatever it takes, right?
Yeah.
Although that was Essendon's theme a few years ago and that didn't work out too
Sacrifice
well.
Sacrifice a goat.
No, not that one. It was whatever it takes, which included peptides. So your most influential church leader in your life?
Oh, Dave Ferguson.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a few, Alan Hirsch, Michael Frost, Mark Connor, but I mean, really substantial movement stuff is Dave.
Yeah.
Just totally saw in me as a young 35-year-old. And, I mean, I got to preach at Exponential on the main stage of Rick Warren's church with Francis Chan. That was all him, opened doors for me, endorsed my book, just amazing leader of leaders.
So he just hasn't written the book, he actually lives it.
Yes, he totally does. Everything in that book he's done for me.
Yep, awesome. Last question. If you could sum up leadership with one word, what would it be?
Service, servant. Yeah.
Jesus came not to be served but to serve, right?
Yeah.
To give his life, and that's what we're called to do as well. Great way to finish the podcast, mate. I have loved our chats and today and all of our chats over the years, but today's been wonderful. We all know the best stuff is not published, so next month when we meet, there'll be some great stuff that no one will ever hear. But what you've said today has been great, and I've loved having you on the show, and thanks for your friendship, mate.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening to the As One Leadership Podcast. Getting you in the room with experienced leaders so you can grow and thrive as a leader. This podcast is hosted by Luke Williams and brought to you by Follow Baptist Church. If you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app for free and leave a review. Your feedback will help us to grow further and bring new, insightful content to you. For those watching on YouTube, please like this video, leave a comment, and subscribe to the Follow Baptist Church channel. Ultimately, if you found this episode valuable, please share it with others who can also benefit from it. We can't wait to share more experiences and knowledge in our next episode. From Melbourne to the world.